Okay, so we've been focusing a lot on the barriers, but through our research, we also looked at what are the facilitators? So how do we get over this issue? What has been done in this area already that has shown success for engaging families more in the research process?
Thanks, Thackeray. I think some of the facilitators that were shown, and I should say, I didn't say earlier, but I meant to say that when I talk about fathers, I'm talking not just about hetero fathers or cisgender fathers. I'm talking about anyone who identifies as male, who is involved in childcare, shall we say. Because 20% of same-sex couples are involved, have children, and I expect that number to grow. So I also tried to look a little bit at what some of the barriers and facilitators were for those groups. But facilitators, we're back on facilitators. So basically, as other people have indicated, recruitment should be broken down into, who you're really after, and specified so that you have specific strategies to encourage their participation. So, broken down by race or ethnicity, fathers tend to self-segregate. They like to go out with the guys. I think that's kind of a universal thing. I'm making sweeping assumptions of the kind one should never make. But some facilitators that were mentioned in the literature were finding opportunities for pediatric research in social services, in barbershops, playgrounds, on public transportation, sporting events, father support groups, on the internet or in person when COVID is over. The brevity of the study was of great importance to fathers because they didn't want to be involved with something that was going to continuously interrupt their life. And and the credibility of the organization was also very important. And I think, some of these things hit all of our groups, but some of them, like the sporting events, I hadn't thought about that. Barbershops, I hadn't thought about that. Father support groups, that seems to be a very good place. And I think sometimes, we go to a quote unquote parent support group and sort of hope that that's going to have everybody, but it doesn't necessarily. So that's.
Yeah, thank you, Laura. So looking at the facilitators for engaging the Indigenous population in research, there were definitely quite a few. One of the main facilitators for engagement was go to them. Do not expect them to come to you, because many people who identify as Indigenous live in remote areas, and it's very difficult to access research opportunities when you live so far away and you may not have access to really good Wi-Fi, and it may be very difficult to look up these research opportunities. So if you're doing research on an Indigenous population, it's always best to go to them and give them that opportunity instead of waiting for them to come to you. Another facilitator was, and I mentioned this before as a barrier, one way to get around this issue of not knowing the language and the culture is to familiarize yourself with the language and the culture and make sure that any people you are working with feel welcome and respected in their role in the research. Thirdly, many forms of literature use a skill-based approach when defining the roles between the researchers and the participants, especially in family-engaged research. So you use a skill-based approach, which means you take what the people are good at and you use them in the most appropriate way possible. So yes, researchers may have more skills at, say writing the manuscript, but your participants may be very interested and very, very quick readers. So this is always that would be a very good opportunity for them to maybe support the completion of a literature review at the beginning of the article. And lastly, one of the facilitators for engagement is to offer diverse opportunities for engagement. So not very often there will be some form of compensation to increase the engagement with the population you are working with. But sometimes it doesn't always have to be a form of like a monetary value. It can always be, you can offer these participants the option to present at a conference with the researchers or go back to their community and present their findings, say at their local community center or at a church or something like that. And then of course, the other one was to offer authorship, to let everyone know and that they did the work and to help advertise that they were just as big, they played just as big of a role as everyone else did.
Yes, through my research, a lot of the themes that both Laurel and Nick have touched on so far are true also for recent immigrants to Canada. One study I read suggested that the number one motivator for immigrants to be part of studies is because they want to learn more about the topic itself. They want that information in a way that they can digest it, so in their language. And this was something that really surprised me, that this wasn't taken into account. So for instance, one of the studies I looked at said we wanted to engage older women that where English is a second language. And so we reached out and we found out that one of the barriers was that we had everything in English and our speakers only spoke English. So once we brought in an interpreter, then our recruitment got better. But I mean, it's a little surprising that that wasn't the consideration right from the beginning. Other studies did point out that simply advertising via posters, even in if they're in different languages, in areas where they tend to congregate, was not very successful for some of these studies. So even if you put a poster in a particular language in community centers or churches where people of that language tend to congregate, that wasn't as successful as word of mouth. So by word of mouth, we mean individuals in the community saying, hey, you should be a part of this. And so that's where you really need to engage the community leaders. And I think Nick already touched on that with regards to the indigenous population. So one group really advocated for what's called the snowball method. And so that's the method where you connect with a key community leader and ask them for help. They'll usually identify some people they think would be interested in participating. And the fact that it's a key community leader, for instance, let's say a priest, really goes a long way to fostering trust. And once people participate and they find the involvement valuable and they know that, oh, I am actually getting paid, they followed through on their promise, then they're going to often share that study with their friends and your participant recruitment numbers will go up. Another facilitator that was brought up in the research was conducting the research either in the participant's home or in a familiar setting like a community center. So that really goes back to the point of go where they are that both Laurel and Nick brought up. Like, you need to go where they are and you need to facilitate trust. And just like all of us, we're more comfortable in settings we've been to before. So if there's any way to adjust your research so they don't have to come to the lab, so they don't have to come to a new place, then that's an effort that needs to be made. And again, one of the biggest facilitators was use of language interpreters right from the beginning. It really helps people feel more comfortable.
Right. And the facilitators for lower income groups really overlap with many of the other groups that we've already mentioned. So one of the big themes for facilitators for this group is around making participation easier. So like everyone has said already, but providing transportation or avoiding the need for transportation entirely, doing things like providing childcare, reducing the effort and costs on the participant part. Also ensuring flexibility to account for the differences and fluctuations in ability to participate. And then another facilitator that I hadn't thought of is providing training and ongoing mentorship for new participants who might be uncomfortable or unfamiliar with the process. So we know that one of the biggest barriers for this group is a lack of awareness or engagement in the research. So they might not know how to go about partnering with researchers or even participating in research. So providing training and mentorship or even a go-between so that they are more comfortable in that role. And then lastly, similar to what Nick said around the role of incentives, so one of the big things is incentives. And for this group, financial incentives are particularly important, but not the only kind. So there are also social incentives. So things like being part of a group or doing something for their community can be a social incentive. And then personal incentives like learning new information. And really, you see the best results when you layer all of these incentives. So you might have a financial incentive, but also layer on the importance of the social benefits that they might get out of participation or the personal benefits.
It's interesting how much overlap there really is between these various groups in the best way to approach them.
My biggest takeaways from all of this is how many similarities there are between the barriers and facilitators for engaging the different groups that we identified, which makes sense because the groups aren't mutually exclusive, right? People's identities intersect at many of these groups. And because many of the barriers and facilitators are connected or they do overlap, it makes me wonder about the potential for some sort of like universal design that uses these facilitators to cater to all of those populations, as well as they would also capture the populations that we traditionally recruit for participation, and then also adding on layers that are needed to, or having more of a concerted effort to reach specific populations within that universal design as well.
One thing, you know, we've talked about some of those, but one thing that is missing, and I would say is a general barrier, is funding to lay the groundwork for doing this kind of relationship building, research into how a specific group might be better approached. And I think until institutions and funders start to recognize that, I mean, they're recognizing, oh yes, we want a wide swath of the Canadian population. But you know, there's how do we do that without the funds and the people and the time to do these things?
I think you're absolutely right about that, Laurel. I mean, when you have a limited window of a grant, when you can conduct a study and they're expecting you to produce a certain amount of research and data within a certain time point, if they're not building into that grant both the time and the money it will take to lay that groundwork, then we're always going to stop short of actually having an inclusive study that's representative of the Canadian population as a whole.
Yeah, and I think Fakhri, you bring up a really good point about they may not build in that amount of time and resources that you need, and the time and resources that a researcher may need to conduct efficacious family engaged research will be very long if we don't take courses like this family engaged research course. You know, before I joined this course, I would have no idea what to do, and I would be spending an enormous amount of time and probably resources as well doing a trial and error session. And you know, when you have that limited window you mentioned, it's, you don't have the availability to do a trial and error. So learning how to do family engaged research before you attempt to do family engaged research can maybe remediate that issue of make that window, the window size may not change, but you can be able to fit through it a little bit easier.
And if you know what you need to do because you've taken a course like this, you've just been able to argue why you need that time in your grant proposal. So having this information ahead of time really can help say, actually, I do need more than 2 years for this. I need 3 because the first year is going to be building these relationships with the community leaders or something along those lines. What does diversity mean to you? So in my mind, when I think about diversity, sometimes it's the absence of the weird acronym. So anybody who is not white, educated from an industrialized nation, or industrialized rich nation, with a democratic society. So if you don't fall under any one of those terms, then therefore you are diverse. But I think it's probably a little bit more nuanced than that. When we think about diversity, often what we mean is marginalized. So who is it that's marginalized in our society? Who is it that's underrepresented?
Yeah, I think Nick and Laura, well, everyone really hit the nail on the head. So acknowledging that having diverse representation in research takes time, I think is one of the key things that we're saying here. It might not always be feasible within the limited windows that, say, grants might give you. So having an acknowledgement of how much time it does take to lay the groundwork for those relationships before even getting into actually doing the research, right? And then I think also we brought up how the importance of diversity in our research. So we know that some of the worst health outcomes are seen in some of the groups that we're talking about today. And that might be because of their underrepresentation in research. So I think in order to best serve the whole population, we need to really move away from only that weird group and having a more diverse population in our research studies.
I really appreciate the amount of intersectionality that we witness between all of these groups. So I hope that those that are listening are able to learn something from this and plan accordingly. Thank you for your time.
Stay classy, San Francisco or San Diego.